you know, I think it all started, we were asking ourselves questions like, how busy are our lobbies? Like, how valuable is that lobby space? Which ones do we need to staff? And if so, how much? And it was really hard to get that information. Nobody really knew how to find it or track it. And so we started trying to answer these questions. And sometimes we found information that confirmed what we believed. And sometimes we found that a store is much busier or much less busy than we realized. And it really shaped the way we ran our business over time.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Students of Storage. Joined with me today is my co-host, Michael Brevda, as well as Adam Durrell over at American Storage. Hello, Adam.
Hey, Tully. Hey, Michael. Good to see you guys today.
Great to see you. We were just touching base before we had jumped on, hearing a little bit about your exploits into the rowing world. We're happy to report that you've been tapped, I guess is the right term, running the team.
Yeah. No, thank you. It's been a hobby that I'm disappointed I found so late in life. It's something that's been super, super rewarding and a lot of fun, but it is hard. I mean, the time and commitment and whatnot is a lot, but the story of how I got into rowing was truly I wanted the one exercise that I could do the least amount of time to get the most result for. So that was how I picked it, as most people do, I'm sure.
Yeah, maybe that's probably has some ties to how you ended up choosing self-storage.
For sure. Yeah, kind of the maximization function of just, that's how I approach a lot of things in life.
Good. I mean, on that topic, I think it's always interesting hearing how everybody found their way into self-storage. Mine's unique, Michael's is unique, but would love to hear yours and what it's brought you to in present day.
Sure. I've been in storage a little over 9 years now, and I think find your way to storage is a great way to put it, because that truly does seem to be a common path. Everybody's got a little bit of a different story. I found my way to storage. I started in real estate early on, you know, even in my college years, but I was working in the multifamily sector and I was working for one of the larger owner operators. And so I was a small fish in a big pond. But I got to see a lot of kind of interactions of what systems they had in place, what processes they had in place. And then when I was kind of looking for my next opportunity, I saw self-storage and I was surprised, because I remember talking to a few people and they would say things that were just really weird to me. Like they'd say, well, we're a really modern company because we have online payments. And that would just be like, what are you talking about? Like that's, I think that's important, but people were touting it like it was like this new feature that nobody had heard of and felt kind of behind the curve. And the more I dug into it, the more I saw that there's a lot of examples of that where storage tended to lag a little bit some of the other real estate disciplines in terms of kind of innovation and other things. And that kind of attracted me to it. Man, this is a place where I think I can actually add some value. I think I know what to do here to help push this, at least my little very tiny corner of it forward. I have some ideas. So that's how I got started. And it's been a lot of fun since.
That's awesome. How would you say that you explored and scratched that itch with regards to areas of opportunity? I know one thing that immediately comes to mind is like when we first met at that North Carolina SSA event and we're chatting, and then we got to talking over the course of the next couple of weeks and months, you highlighted like how you utilize cameras at different properties to identify when an existing customer had walked in or maybe a potential new one. I'm curious, like what other kind of things you've tweaked or hacked over the years?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's probably too much to get into here, but I can pick one or two examples of kind of things that I've hacked around over the years. One of them was there seems to be so much friction around storage in general, whether it be the rental process, whether it be the payment process, whether it be there's some owner operator, and I'm not disparaging or saying these practices are bad, but just there do tend to be these habits and that pop up and they kind of persist without a reevaluation of, does this help our business? And an example of that might be, hey, we require a driver's license and for every move in. And if they don't have a driver's license, we don't rent to them. And if they can't come during business hours, we're not going to rent to them. And we're not going to give them the gate code until they perform verification steps A, B, and C. And many of these things kind of in isolation have good ideas. There's merit to them. But then when you take them in aggregate, they put up these little roadblocks that may be bigger barriers to customers than people realize when they're kind of designing them up in their head. And then so for me, you know, one of those friction points was just simply paying their bill. And people had a hard time. They had a complicated login process. People don't remember their passwords. I mean, people don't remember their passwords in general, much less for their storage account. I mean, just interacting with customers, you realize that they don't think about their storage very much, and you kind of want it that way. You want them to spend as little brain power as possible thinking about their storage unit. But it was just really hard for people to pay their bill, and I didn't want them to call me. I wanted them just to do it. I wanted as little effort there as possible. And so I built a little system that would send people these, we called them quick pay links, that would pre-authenticate the customer. And so without a login, they could go in, they could enter a credit card, they could pay their bill. And then the same thing for over the phone, they could call in, they could authenticate, and then they could pay their bill right over the phone. Because there's people that just really like to pay that way and just were convinced that was the right way to pay their bill. By automating those things, it took more and more load off of personnel that run the operation, where they're not doing as much of that day to day. And then, you know, fast forward to cameras. You know, now with the prevalence of the internet, we're able to do things that we weren't able to do in the past. The camera detection is we have cameras in our lobbies, feed those into a central computer. And whenever a person walks in, we flag that event, we store it in a database. We send a notification to the manager to tag it and say, hey, who was this? Was this a customer, an employee, or a new rental perhaps? So we have this really good insight into, well, how busy are our stores? You know, I think it all started, we were asking ourselves questions like, how busy are our lobbies? Like, how valuable is that lobby space? Which ones do we need to staff? And if so, how much? And it was really hard to get that information. Nobody really knew how to find it or track it. And so we started trying to answer these questions. And sometimes we found information that confirmed what we believed. And sometimes we found that a store is much busier or much less busy than we realized. And it really shaped the way we ran our business over time. And that's been a lot of the pursuit of just, hey, how can we be as efficient as possible? And to be efficient, you need good data.
Yeah, couldn't agree more about it. And I think it's interesting, right, when you look at it from like a CapEx, OpEx perspective, being able to measure what most consider to be unmeasurable is incredibly valuable. I imagine that it probably affected your bottom line pretty significantly, especially when you're looking at it across 15, 17 plus stores. I imagine also at the same time, there might have been an initial pushback from your team. But I think one thing that you've done an exceptional job of that I've witnessed is, you know, explaining the why. And I think that I'd be interested in kind of hearing, like, how do you think about hiring? How do you think about training? How do you think about working with your team so that they have a concrete understanding of, like, why we are driving towards an end result, or why are we making those changes?
That's a really good question. And personnel is, I think, always front and center for a lot of people's mind and storage. For me, I think back to, I've evolved a lot on this over the years, but I think when I first started, I had a pretty rigid approach both to hiring and to training. And I think over the years, I've realized that, well, I was really inspired by a book by Reed Hastings. It's called No Rules. It's about Netflix. There's some stuff in there that's applicable, some stuff that's not. But the piece that really spoke to me was the part about personnel and training. And it really focused on the idea that you want people that can make good decisions, and you want to give people enough context about your business so that they know how to make the right decision in a variety of situations. And I think sometimes there's a tendency, and I feel this too, to make a set of if-then statements to barricade people into forcing them to make the right decision. But I think in practice, when you really barricade people down through policy and procedure so narrowly, you get people that are afraid to make decisions. And instead of making decisions, they'll make easy ones. But if they get to one that's even a little bit tough, they just, they freeze up, they don't make it, they postpone. And that slowness is really difficult. And that can be true even when you're talking about a new rental who wants to rent a unit. If they have the power to tweak things a little bit, but to get that next move in, I really want them to do that. I want each of my team members to just do it. We can always analyze it afterward and review it later, but I'd much rather be on the more aggressive side. Hey, if we have to change the rent $10 to get that person to sign right now, I would much rather do that than the person hangs up with them. You know, my manager hangs up with the potential customer. They call me and they say, hey, what do you think about dropping the rate $10? Then I go through an analysis. By the time we call that person back, we may have lost the opportunity to rent them a unit. I'd much rather move a little bit faster. And so that's kind of permeated like my approach to training and to hiring, which is really, can I get people who are comfortable making decisions and who can be trained with that context? I open up my P&Ls to my team. Each manager who works for me has the entire P&L for the properties that they manage. So they see the revenue and the expense. And that leads to a lot of tough conversations. It was hard to do that. Any change is hard, but the end result was people that are a little more in tune with the business than they were before. And so I think it was a positive change.
Totally. I think being able to give somebody a sense of ownership, right, changes their frame of mind when they're showing up to work, right? Like at the end of the day, like they have a stake in the game. Might be a smaller stake than most, but it still impacts the business. And I imagine like when you're having these team meetings that it makes it much better for people to kind of showcase and highlight things that they've noticed to share with their colleagues. So that's really impressive and something I've admired. We had a great conversation last week with Jonas, who's Michael's very close with. And I feel like you guys overlap with regards to how you view personnel and also how you view the prospective tenant, right? Creating true empathy, understanding, but also eliminating roadblocks, right? It might not be the most attractive from a like clear cut, this is what you do, if then situation. But I think that as like your business, it's much more organic and the results kind of show up, especially because you're measuring them. So
totally. Well, I think you hit on something important there, the ownership. The more someone feels like they have control over what they're doing, whether it be a task, process, a store, a company, you know, whatever unit you put there, that ownership always makes people care about it a little bit more versus if it's just, I'm doing a job, I'm collecting a paycheck and absolutely nothing else, then it's, you don't get that same investment and return from people or any metric.
What's been holding your attention or your interest? You know, like you've been with Cubby now for like a year and a half. You've been extremely like influential with regards to where we've taken the product, whether that be in revenue management or call center operations, or just like general feedback around reporting and analytics. What's holding your, I'm just curious to hear what's holding your attention. What do you want to kind of see as the next area of opportunity as it relates to technology and self-storage? It doesn't have to be Cubby, but just,
That's a great question. And at the risk of sounding reductive, I'm gonna say AI, and that'll probably half of people will be like, and half of you will be like, no, because it is a polarizing topic. But, you know, I will say, I think, and I'll go back to something just briefly, just to give some context. One thing that I really enjoyed about our early conversations, Tully, was when we were exploring Cubby, we had a really hard time with simple parts of our new customer workflow. If someone's on our website and they put in their contact information, I want to save that immediately and do something with that. And that seemed to be an idea that just lagged and lagged. And that's one thing I've so much enjoyed about our conversations over the years and working with Cubby is that I feel like that desire to push forward, to move quick, and to be at the forefront of where customers are is so important. You know, I feel like there's just great alignment on that. That's something I've really enjoyed. As for the question on technology, you know, I think AI is such an unlocking technology, but people are just now figuring out how to apply it and how to use it in their businesses. I think the use cases that we see today are going to be different than the use cases we see tomorrow, but I think there's no doubt in my mind that it has the capacity to kind of do what a lot of the other enhancements that Cubby has led. I think it has that opportunity to kind of continue to unlock efficiencies for people. So whether it be automating more tasks, I think AI really has the ability to unlock that in some pretty powerful ways. And I think the applications that we're seeing are just now getting built for that, but are going to be pretty impactful when they are.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah, I would tend to agree. I think that there's so many efficiencies and we have certain applications of AI present in other industries that have been around for quite some time, right? The ability to create multiple workflows, to create like automatic follow-up actions, self-storage, and like fortunate or unfortunately has kind of been on the later side of that. I imagine that you've been able to use tools like Make.com or Zapier integration to solve for a number of this, but it's kind of kludgy. And I think I learned that word from you. So grateful for that. I think we have touched upon briefly, like reporting analytics. You do tend to get into the weeds as it relates to utilizing like a Google BigQuery integration into your facility management software, whether you were doing data carves previously or now being able to do it in real time. What are the things that you believe that a number of operators might be overlooking as it relates to reporting? And why is a business intelligence tool so powerful in your perspective?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think the major paradigm, let's just say 3 or 4 years ago in storage, I think was primarily this report-driven paradigm where you go and request data. Now, maybe you have it on a schedule where it gets emailed to you, but it was very much this kind of request report. You'd get some pre-canned thing, and then you could interface with that company, try and increase its utility. But generally, you're kind of with this pre-canned report, and you had to learn how to use what was on that report. That was kind of your only option. There wasn't really anything you could do beyond that. Then with BigQuery, and we use kind of Power BI as an interface to pull that data in, we can pull in data from our own tools, right? So like that database that tracks customers coming into stores. If I want to correlate lead conversion at the store level with visits per month, I can do that. And I can ask that question and say, hey, you know, I wonder if these two things are connected. And they may or they may not be. But something that previously, like, you'd have to spend hours on probably to compile a report from one software and from another software. If you want to answer it across multiple stores, right, it's going to take a long time to kind of correlate that data. You're going to get a one-time answer. And then if you want to ask the same question again or over a different data period, you have more work to do. And that's where the business intelligence tools really unlock that, is you can ask that question. Maybe it's a dead end. Maybe there's absolutely no relationship between those two things and they're just, it was a curiosity, but then you know that and you can move on and say, hey, you know what? These things have no relation. Visits and closing rate are not related. So I don't have to spend time thinking about this anymore. I wonder if, does time of day impact it? Is there a correlation between people that come in at the end of the day? Are they in a rush trying to beat our closing hours? Do they close at a higher percentage? Maybe that's something I should look at. And you can just dive into your data in this deeper way. And sometimes you get really great insights and sometimes you don't. But the point is you're able to ask questions and get answers quickly. And that, to me, just feels like it kind of unlocks the speed at which you can move forward because you're getting answers really quickly and you're able to kind of explore that tangent until your curiosity is satiated and you know, like, oh, there's something here or there's nothing here and I don't need to think about it. I can free up that brain space to go do other things.
Yeah. And a lot of people talk about like historical trends and like historical data. I'm curious to get your take on, what are the pros and cons of utilizing historical data in your opinion, right? I imagine at least at like high level, sometimes people get stuck with, oh, the seasonal trends, like, we're noticing something different. Well, COVID impacted it and created a completely different scenario that throws off how we view revenue management, right? In this kind of race to the bottom with the REITs, but would love your kind of thoughts around that.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think what's interesting about historical trends, the way I feel about historical data is it's really good to know how you did. That's super important. But I also don't think it can also be blinders in a way. So one example of that, I think COVID's a great example that if I'll use an example that I think is relative or relevant to storage, which is if you have an idea in your mind of what the price of a 10 by 10 should be, and you went into COVID with that idea and you didn't raise your rates, then you probably got to 100% occupancy. And you may have not realized that you could have raised them earlier and higher. You had no idea. You don't know what the ceiling for your market is because you hit 100%. And that it speaks to the reliance on historical data, right? Like this is what the price used to be. Therefore, the price really can't be much different than what it used to be. But in actuality, it changed a lot and it changed quickly. And I think although we don't always know what the shocks may be, whether it be something local to that market or whether it be kind of industry-wide, there's always the chance for kind of disruptive forces, both positive and negative. And if you're so bounded by what you've done in the past that you're unable to anticipate big and or sudden changes in the present and future, then your historical data kind of is a handicap to you. So I think it's good as a benchmark to know, hey, this is how we did, but I don't think it should be the ultimate ruler for how we should operate and what we should expect today. That's what I think about historical data. I think it's, yeah. So I'm curious your thoughts. What do you see? What do you think?
No, I think you hit the nail on the head with regards to like how I view it. I think it's really important to see from like an operational perspective how you performed year over year, right? Notice like trends are important, but they're not the end all be all. Markets change, tactics change around pricing, occupancy, saturation, all of those influence, right? How you adjust prices over time. I think it's important to look, but to die on that hill is a dangerous one, but to each their own. And I think one thing I'd be curious, kind of following up on that note, is what are some of the changes that you've noticed with regards to revenue management? So whether that's for prospective tenants, existing tenants, and I've been hearing a lot more about this idea of stay rates. So how do we get to a point where we're starting to understand when a potential tenant might want to move out, and how do we keep them in there? Would love your thoughts. I know that's pretty broad, but...
Oh, man, that's a big question. So talking about revenue management and the two sides of it, kind of your existing tenant rate increases, ECRIs, and what you're setting your street rates at, is that a good kind of talking about those broadly?
Yeah. I mean, if you think that there's anything a little bit more pointed that's kind of come up in your discussions, I'd love to hear it. But I think a lot of folks... I get the sense that a lot of folks are starting to think more about strategically about revenue management, in particular ECRIs, because it might have been a place where they've just been adjusting by 3 or 5% every 6 months. And then that's just kind of the way things have rolled. But a couple of percentage points here or there based off of different tenants can have a pretty significant impact when compounding. So I guess that's directed towards Michael. Do you want to add anything?
I can just add as well, like specifically on the existing tenant rate increase side, I know you ask a lot of questions and do things differently than a lot of groups that we talk to. Are there any interesting correlations or factors that you look at when looking at raising like Tully's rate versus my rate that matter? So there's obviously length of stay and like since last change and difference from street rate. Can I backfill if this person moves out at a higher or lower rate? But beyond those like basic factors, are you looking at things like gate access activity or how far from the facility they live or some of these other factors that I think are really interesting and nuanced versus, to Tully's point, I would say the majority of groups that I talk to have their rules about at 9 months, every single person gets a 5% and that's that. Whereas no two customers are actually exactly alike. So we'd love to just maybe start with the ECRI side and then anything on the street rate side that is of interest to you.
You both hit on a good point there, which I think when I started in storage 9 years ago, I heard there was debate at that time about whether rate increases were good or bad. There was still kind of this divide of should we do them, should we not? Then over time, that got to the point where most people were like, yeah, you got to do rate increases to your existing customers. And so I saw that change over time, people recognizing that, hey, these are good. And I think that's a good starting point for people today is if you can't do anything else, you should at least have some type of schedule, some rule that you follow that puts you in that habit of doing it. If you're not in the habit of doing it, you'll fall behind quicker than you realize. That's the baseline to start from. I think as you start to get more, like, how can we optimize this? You know, one of the things we do is we do move out surveys. So we track why people are leaving and we test that. We see how that changes over time. And we see that about 4% of customers list rate increases as the reason for move out over time. It continues to be, we've tested this different ways. So we have ongoing surveys and we've done usually a big one-time survey every summer to try and hey, let's update this. Let's make sure that we haven't fallen out of touch here. But it's always less than people think. And so what I like to do when I'm training my team.
4%.
What is that?
Yeah.
Just 4%.
A 14.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's super, super small. And then the leading is by 85% is for life event. So it's by far and away, life event is still the one that people leave for. And when you read the comments, because there's a comments field for people to leave additional notes. The comments often go something like this. it's, well, I didn't like the rate increases, but the reason I left was because I moved into my house or life event X, Y, or Z. So they'll remember the rate increases. They do remember them. It's not like they erase, but the actual reason was still the life event. And that continues to hold true over majority of people. Anyway, the point being there is that it's always less than you think. And so I do this exercise with my team where we review these numbers. I always ask the team, hey, how many people move out because of a rate increase? 100 customers that moved out this month across our company. How many of those moved out because they got a rate increase and were upset by it? You know, what are your guesses? 20, 30, 40. And when you hear that it's 4, it's just that surprise. It's like, really? And then we go through and we look at the responses and we all kind of get on the same page and realize the people that those 4 can be very vocal and very loud, but they do represent a minority of the people who moved out. And so that vocal minority can make it feel disproportional. And then cycling it all back to the rate increase of what do you decide to give someone? I think generally you want to look at the occupancy of the unit type. You want to look at the occupancy of the facility. The more and more data you can kind of pull in to make that decision, the better. Even kind of leasing velocities. Are we renting a lot right now? Are we seeing a lot of move outs? Can kind of temper how aggressive or how conservative you want to be. I toyed with a vacancy loss kind of calculator. If this person moves out, you know, assuming that 4% probability of move out, what is the, like, I can estimate a vacancy loss off of each rate increase that I give of what each one on a percentage basis will give me. Sort of like how in NBA, they move to like the effective or the estimated point value of a shot. You know, you can estimate the vacancy loss, the risk of each rate increase on kind of a case-by-case basis. And if one is high risk, then, you know, you don't have to do it, even if it's on the cycle. And if one is low risk, then, you know, that's one you should definitely increase. And so it gives you just that additional parameter to kind of do a few more when that risk is low and do a few less when the risk is high. And you can just use that as kind of a barometer to kind of be more targeted with it.
Totally. I wish the Celtics had followed your advice last night as it gone down 2 games after blowing 1-point leads.
The emotion just plays into it so much. You can know the right thing, but...
You live in New York City, Tony. You got to be a Knicks fan.
Oh, man. My condolences.
We got a ring.
Basketball analogy. Like, I hate when you see someone take like a long 2 with their foot on the line. It's probably like my most boomer trait. What are you doing? I take a step back, like drive it to the, like, it's not rocket science. Like, it's a really difficult shot for the same amount of point.
It correlates exactly right. And I think the emotion component of it too, of that's easy to forget. That's part of why software like Cubby is so useful, is that the more you can take the emotion out of it and stick to your plan, the better it works. I think generally, certainly on at any scale, you know, maybe single owner operator, you might could do it by gut a little better, but at any scale of 2-3 plus stores, you got to have that plan to follow. And otherwise, you'll make bad decisions. You'll have your toe on the line and miss a bad, almost 3-point shot.
Well, I think that that's a good place to jump off on. Les, Michael, you think if you've got any additional questions you wanted to ask?
Yeah, I have one more question while you're here, if you don't mind spending a couple minutes with Adam.
No, go for it.
We just got back from ISS Las Vegas, and like, as a vendor who is familiar with the space, I was a little overwhelmed at just all of the options that are available to groups now, even year over year since last year. Can you talk to us a little bit more? Obviously, you use Cubby today, but for the average operator out there trying to figure out what they should do from like a software and a technology perspective, like, what are some of the questions that they should be asking to make sure that they're not just adding more tools on top of a shaky foundation or just grasping at straws? You know, I sense a lot of like, well, I heard AI was important, let's go buy something that has AI in the name. Not really thinking about like the outcome it's driving. So I know you can be as detailed or not as you want, but I thought that would be something you'd have a good opinion on.
That's a really good question. And it may be different for different operators. In fact, I'm sure it is. You know, I think one of the hardest parts about the storage industry is it's both its strength and its weakness is its diversity. There are so many options for every part of kind of your technology stack, your even tenant insurance, right? There's a bazillion options. And sometimes it's hard to get a consensus on what is good, what should I do, what shouldn't I do. some of that's held back by these longstanding beliefs about what is even legal or not legal in my state, right? You know, like, oh, I heard 10 years ago that we couldn't send electronic lien notices, so we don't send electronic lien notices, even though it may have changed. And so the advice I would give to people, or like the recommendations to people, is you've got to have a really good grasp on what your business strategy is. I also know, just from a practical standpoint, the more things you bolt on or add on, the harder they are to interoperate. And that's just universally true, not just in storage, but if you buy your software from one company and you buy another piece from another company and an AI bolt on from a fifth company, and your gate is probably already somebody else, you know, already, and your phone system is somebody else already, you already got a lot of pieces to try and plug in together. I think the fewer those pieces you have to plug and make work together, the better, you know. And I, you know, shameless plug for Cubby here, I talked about my QuickPay links earlier, and I was really proud of that back in the day, man. I thought I was innovative. That took time for me to maintain. My ability to facilitate easy payments took away from my time pushing the other parts of the business forward. And when I met with you, I realized, hey, I can take some of these things off my plate. And instead of me being the bolt on, I can have our software do that for me. And that was that helped a ton, kind of unlock my time and be able to say, hey, you know what? Like, I don't have to spend my time maintaining these things anymore or doing X, Y, and Z. The more we can kind of bring under one umbrella, that's going to make us better just by virtue of reducing complexity. And then on top of features working well, that's going to be kind of that next step change in intensity. And I'll share one final plug that I think is one thing I've been working on is gate access. So, you know, we switched away. I built my own gate solution, keypads, the whole bit, so that I could have control of that data and do whatever I wanted to with it to see when my customers are coming in and out, and manage it the way that I wanted to manage it. And one of the things that I'm just is tickling my brain right now is when people are moving out, they move out, they don't tell you when they're going to move out, right? You'd really like for customers to be like, hey, I'm thinking about moving out. What can you do for me? And obviously, if given that chance, most people would like, yeah, of course, let's work together. I want you to be a customer as long as you need storage. But if they've already rented the U-Haul truck and they've already got the unit loaded up, they're gone. But that usage follows predictable patterns. And so what I'm trying to do now is predict based on gate access usage if someone is moving out at that moment, so you can reach out to them before they've loaded up that U-Haul and see if there's a chance to save them, or just to use that to reach out in a more proactive fashion. So I think that'll be really interesting to see how that works.
Are people coming more often or less often right before they move out?
Well, so the access pattern is typically right before your billing cycle. So there's an uptick. So it's like when they use it, and people who are moving out are usually moving out on a weekend, and then time of day matters. And if you see several consecutive back-to-back where there wasn't a pattern of consecutive back-to-back before, you're almost guaranteed that's, you know, that's increases the probability of it being a move out. So I'm at about 80% consistency, but I want to get it to 95 before I start actually notifying people, because I think it's going to be a little weird at first when people get a text a few minutes after their gate code of being like, hey, here, you're moving out. You know, I don't know how to say that part yet, but we'll get there.
Where you going, neighbor? Yeah.
Yeah.
You moved in 18 months ago. You've never come back. And now you've been back 3 times in the last 3 days. Are you moving out? Question mark.
Interesting.
Right. Yeah. Right. I think something not creepy, like, hey, why don't you just take that U-Haul back and leave your stuff in storage a few more months? No, I'm teasing. I don't know what to say yet, but I'll figure that out. So if you have any suggestions, let me know. I'm looking for ideas.
Maybe leave them like a $20 Dunkin' gift card in the unit with a nice note. Okay.
We'll miss you. Yeah.
Love it.
Like, I know this is not something that functions inside of Covey today. It doesn't really matter, but I'm curious to get your thoughts since we're on the topic. Like, the tenant portal, do you know, like, how many of your existing customers ultimately rent a second unit? And are there, like, predictive insights that you look at or activity that you're kind of monitoring to see if an existing tenant goes and creates a new lead or expresses interest in looking at a unit? And I wonder if there's kind of triggers that we could extract from Cubby just based off of activity. I know they can't rent a unit inside of their tenant portal today, but yeah, I wonder if we could track existing tenants in some way.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think what we see is there are tenants that need a second unit. And probably the most common reason is they underestimate how much stuff they have. It's a common thing, right? People are shopping on a kind of price basis, and they're not really, you know, they're just not familiar with how to correlate 10 by 15 into what their stuff packed up actually would look like. That's a common reason. It's just, hey, I underestimated. And then a second is kind of like a needs change thing. But the takeaway is once people have rented that first unit, as long as they had a good experience, they don't shop the second time. The first time they're shopping, the statistics I've heard are they call about three or more stores. They visit one or more stores, you know, usually three in one is kind of the rough numbers I've heard. Maybe that's different now, but the second unit, they don't really shop for it. They call you and just, hey, boom, can I get it? And that's where the big value is. We use Slack for communication internally. So we run kind of like a, probably relative to other organizations, a pretty tight organization where, you know, managers talk to managers in a collaborative way frequently, just to give some context. But when a lead comes in off the website, if it's one of those abandoned checkouts or somebody who was inquiring or just they didn't get all the way to buying it, that pops right into our Slack channel so we can action it within seconds, just to like, hey, what's going on? If they're existing customer, we can do that manually, but that'd be awesome to like integrate that with like existing customers. That'd be so cool to make it even more seamless.
Yeah, it's fun ideating on this kind of stuff, but
yeah, it's little improvements make a big difference over time. You know, it's there's no one silver bullet, but there's a lot of little ones that make a big change in the end.
Yeah, as Michael always says, scraps make a pile.
I like it.
That's what I was going to bring up earlier. Is one thing I think that you do really well, that's kind of your superpower compared to some of the operators that I talk to, is you're always asking those sorts of questions and you never stop. There's lots of groups out there, some of whom we speak with, some of whom we work with, some of whom we don't. Check the bottom number every month about how much did we bring in this month. Cool. And then they're only reacting or doing things differently if they see a huge difference in that ultimate number. But I think there's some folks out there that bought their facilities 30, 40, 50 years ago, and it's now just a coupon clipper. And that's great. Like, you actually don't need to maximize revenue probably in that instance. But for everyone trying to actually run a storage business is what I would say. Continuing to ask these questions, I think, is super important about where are the bottlenecks? Where are the friction points? Where are the areas that we can improve that's going to make a difference to that bottom number? Like, we all like to see the bottom number go up, but you have to do stuff to make that happen.
Yeah, that's a really good insight. The input signals that change that bottom number, you know, they're there, but you always got to be looking for them. Yeah, if you want to catch them before they make the bottom number go down.
Once the bottom number starts to fall off a cliff, it's typically too late.
Yeah. So hard to reverse that trend.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time on a Friday to chat with a little old us, but always a pleasure.
Oh, you bet. Well, Michael Tully, always a pleasure. Great to see you guys. Glad to hear you guys are doing well and always great to catch up.
Yeah. Talk soon. Thanks, Adam.
All right. Bye, guys. See ya.
Thank you for listening to Students of Storage. Links to any resources mentioned in the episode can be found in the show notes. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a 5-star review and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss out on any future episodes.